Welcome to Story Talking with Laksh, episode 74. My name is Laksh, and I started this podcast, 74 episodes ago, to talk about stories, about how I create stories and the stories that inspire me, and to be able to talk to storytellers who I look up to, and I'm fascinated by how they're able to do what they do, and I just want to talk to them about their process and the behind the scenes, really, of what makes someone create something that didn't exist before. So speaking of that, I want to tell you a little bit about my guest this week. We're going to get into his entire career, really, in this episode, but let me just tell you quickly, as much as I can, with a little backstory about him. So my guest this week is Kosar Thakore Padamsi, and in the industry, in he's popularly known as just Q, the letter Q. And Q started a theater production company in college, and you're going to hear about the whole process of how something like that got started. But he's one of the co-founders of a theater production and arts management company called QTP. And along the way, he also was a part of creating something called Thespo, which is a youth-run theater company. And they pull off every year for the last 20 years. They put together a youth theater festival in Mumbai, and that travels all around India. And we go in depth into how Q got into theater through his parents, who were veterans of the industry, and how he found his voice, how he got into starting as an actor in theater, how he got into directing and then producing, and basically how he has not only created a career in theater, a very successful one, for himself, but also helped nurture some of the extremely prominent voices in the Indian arts community and in the Indian film industry and theater industry and the TV industry through Thespo and QTP. So Q was nice enough to have me at his home in Mumbai earlier this week. So we sat down and I basically just asked him to tell me his story, and it is fascinating and inspiring. And for someone like me who has always loved theater and playwriting and raw storytelling, where you're so connected with your audience, this was a real treat. So without much ado, here is my conversation with Q on episode 74 of Story Talking with Laksh.
So when we were in college, I was mainly an actor. Then I was offered a college play to direct. And now I was doing acting and directing. So to bifurcate those two roles in my own head, mm-hmm. In the credits, it was directed by Q, but acted like the acting was my full name, Kosar Thakore Padamsi. And we did a play called The Night Thoreau Spent in Jail that was quite well received on the college circuit. And then it also got invited to the NCPA. And they suddenly called up and said, "So what's the name of your company?" And the dates that we'd been offered, I would have graduated by then, and so would have a lot of the company, a lot of the gang who were in the play. So we couldn't be the college theater company anymore. So we were like, oh. And Christopher, who is one of our partners, kind of said, "Listen, just call it Q Theater Productions, because you're the director and we're all following you for the moment. So just call it that for now and we'll figure it out later." And we did that. So we said, yeah, it's called Q Theater Production. We're a young college group. We had no idea you needed names or anything like that. And then we did the shows, and then the check came in the name of Q Theater Production. And we were like, oh shit, we need a bank account. And that's literally how it all started. So then we had a Q Theater Productions kind of thing, which was kind of a mistake how we ended up with it.
Right.
But it's always been run very much as a collective. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, we suddenly said, okay, look, that was all fine when we were in college. In fact, more, in 2010, we had a long conversation saying, okay, you know, that was fine. You know, this mistake has endured.
Yeah.
But now let's really firm it up and let's really try and let's be a public-private limited company. And, you know, let's figure that up. And Vivek Rao, who joined the company, was like, okay, he was in charge of putting the structure together. Then we came up with, what the hell do we call ourselves? Now, over time, there's a certain equity that is built up with QTP. Just generally the stuff we've been doing, people have been talking to, you know, just over
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, okay, let's keep the QTP as part of it. Because QTP Productions was often being referred to as QTP just in even when you label a 0-watt lamp or a piece of, you know, furniture, it would be QTP.
Yeah.
So we kept QTP. So now we are QTP Entertainment Private Limited. Because mm-hmm. one is, we're not just a theater company. We do a lot of arts-related stuff. So the Q Theater Productions no longer held as a descriptor of what we did. We changed our logo. We did a whole bunch of mm-hmm. things to properly reflect who we are.
Right.
But right now, it actually doesn't stand. QTP stands for nothing, honestly. I mean, one of our designers came up with, it could be quirky, talented people. It could be quietly thoughtful productions.
Yeah.
It could be, you know.
It's become subjective.
Quality tablas on a plate. You know, it could be anything.
Yeah. You can project whatever it stands for.
I mean, like Microsoft Word or Microsoft has something called QuickTime Protocol. So if you actually Google QTP, that keeps coming.
Yeah.
You know?
So going back to even before college a little bit.
Yeah.
You were born, I mean, I'm assuming because of your parents' careers, you were born into this world. You were like, how, what was the earliest your memory you have been exposed to
so
theater?
My earliest memory of something to do with the stage is, I know, I don't know if this is a reported memory or like something that I actually remember.
Right.
But apparently, my mother was in a play called Death of a Salesman, which my father was also in, and they played husband and wife, Willie and Linda Lohman.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the play, my mother, Linda Lohman, sits there and weeps in the Requiem scene as the husband has killed himself, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, legend has it, that I used to stand, and I remember this quite clearly, but I don't know if it's a projected memory or a real memory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I was 3 years old at the time.
And the story's been told enough for the story to now be
bigger
than
the
memory.
And apparently I used to sit in the tech room, in the tech box and say things like, don't cry, mama, don't cry. Now, I don't know if this is true or not, but I have that vision very, very clear. So that's probably my earliest memory. A lot of memories that come up from an early age actually have startled me or surprised me about being in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
I was dragged to a lot of plays by my mother because she was after the age of 4, I think I was she was a single mom trying to bring me up,
mm-hmm.
And she was a theater reviewer, so that was her job. So I've been dragged to many things, and it wasn't until college actually once when I sat down at the Prithvi Theatre once on the steps.
Mm-hmm.
And Prithvi Theatre is very a very specific coir carpet.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting on that and I got pricked by the coir things, and it triggered a memory of me as a child hating sitting there.
Wow.
Because when you're a child in short pants, it's really uncomfortable, this coir thing. But now here I was, almost an adult and triggering back. And I was like, why can't I enjoy the play? Because, you know, it was all of that. I was very fortunate in the fact that I went away to boarding school. So the pressures or the superimposition of either of my parents on my journey to discovering theater was not there.
Yeah. You were able to find it yourself.
Completely. It was quite remarkable. And I mean, you know, when you're on the 6th standard, 7th standard, you're doing these, you know, whatever, you know, you're playing in a play called Ivan the Good, or you're doing the Panchatantra or whatever, you know, you're being a fox, and all of that is fun and lovely, and you do this school play, and then everyone comes up and says you're so fantastic, and it's a huge high as a kid in a thing. But it wasn't until I was in the 10th standard, actually, and I was acting in a student directed play called The Glass Menagerie, with Tennessee Williams, and I remember working on the play and really finding that there's so much more than just the regular theater that we've been exposed to up till now. And it was during that play and the three other actors and myself, we really had a very intense time and intense play. And then it was the second night, we only had two performances. And the second night in school, there's the closing monologue that Tom says, you know, I didn't go to the moon, I went much further, etc. And I paused in the middle of a section of that. And I felt the audience pause with me. And I can't tell you how magical that feeling felt. It's a complete ego trip. And
right.
It's probably the worst thing for an actor to do. But at that moment, I said, I want theater to be part of my life, no matter what else I do. Mm-hmm. I want this to remain. So I literally know the moment I chose theater, or theater chose me. I remember that moment. I was 15 years old, and I remember thinking, no matter what I do, I want this. And then I think I screwed up the rest of the monologue because I was clearly distracted. But that was quite a thing. So when I came back to Bombay, away from boarding school, and I finished everything and all of that, I had grown up and found theater somewhere else. You know, so I actually had no idea about the scope and breadth of my father's work, particularly, because I had seen very little of it when I used to come on holidays. I mean, yeah, people talk and, you know, whatever. If you were a business family, you talk about business, you know,
so all
of that is there. And it was obvious that he really loved it and he cared very deeply for it. But it was still abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, an uncle of mine, or distant uncle, sat me down one day, and actually we went to Samovar, and he was like, you do know, you know, then he literally walked me through the work and the reputation and all of that. And as someone who's interested in theater, it suddenly became interesting to me, this story, you know, so it wasn't something that I took for granted. It was, I discovered it, as I would discover the work of Habib Tanveer or, you know, Badal Sarkar or whatever. This was a discovery, you know, when you, or, you know, Ibrahim Al-Qazi, it was a discovery, which is quite nice, quite refreshing, because you can look at it from your own perspective, take what you agree with or what you like and, you know, shun the rest. But I mean, obviously they have had a huge influence on my life. I don't know how much of an influence they've had on my work. I think a lot of the choices of the kind of plays I pick as a director is heavily influenced by the kind of people or the kind of person they brought me up to be. So there's always a certain social context. There's always a high premium on the pursuit of quality and hard work. But my father would do these huge, big scale things, and my work is much more small. So we'd sit at a dining table and be completely different people about the kind of work. And that was fantastic, you know. We used to argue about Shakespeare and argue about all sorts of things. It's quite invigorating, quite exciting. So clearly there's that influence. I think my mother's influence on me is slightly larger. Because the one thing that she did, I don't know if she taught me, but I absorbed, was to be greedy about the arts. She's a voracious arts consumer. And it is an incredible generosity of spirit, because she will travel anywhere and everywhere to see almost anything and everything. I mean, on a given evening, she's watching a play, watching an art film, she's attending an art exhibition. And that hunger and curiosity, actually, I think that's the right word, that curiosity is something that I think I appreciate hugely. I mean, as a theater, I'm half a theater creator. I'm also a theater consumer. I love going to the theater. I love watching plays. I watch anywhere between 60 and 100 plays a year, you know, performances a year. I love being in that room. And if I haven't been in that room for 3 weeks or 4 weeks because I'm working on my own stuff or whatever, I suffer withdrawals, you know what I mean? Like, the guys in the office kind of say, because suddenly there'll be a weekend and I say, okay, we're binge watching. And we'll go and watch six or eight plays in a 4 or 5 day period. And we're bouncing around. Like, I mean, there's this friend of mine called Gitanjali who's quite much shorter than I am. And I remember running from the station with her to try and catch a show because it was the second or third thing that we were catching that day. And we had obviously one had spilled and, you know, and we're moving across the city to go and catch something. And she kept going, your legs are longer than mine. I'm really sorry, but we got to go. So I mean, I think that's something. And I think that reflects in the work and the kind of people that I do, which may not just be the productions, but I think it translates to everything else. It is an influence, but it's an influence that is slightly distilled and slightly at a distance. Sure. We're not copies of each other, or it's not a direct legacy inheritance, you know, kind of thing, which I quite appreciate, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite nice. And I've never had the pressure of you must do it like this.
Right.
I found my own school, my own people, my own, you know, whatever.
And so I'm guessing they were able to also attend a bunch of the shows that you were directing and producing.
Yeah, so... In fact, I was telling a friend of mine this story the other night. So the first play I ever directed was in college. And the night before we opened, we were doing a dress rehearsal in college. And I don't think my father knew that. And he turned up with a cake to wish, you know, night before. Mm-hmm. Now, we were in the middle of a run-through, in the middle of Act 1. And the people outside the auditorium told him that. And he went, okay. And then they said, why don't you go in and sit and watch? And he said, no. And he stood outside for about half an hour. Then the interval poem came. Then he came in. He handed the cake to me and the rest of the guys. And then he left. And I didn't think of it at the time. I just thought he'd come and dropped off a cake. You know, it's not a, you know, his vision.
Right.
But in hindsight, when I look back, that was an incredible vote of confidence. That was an incredible vote of, I'll see it on opening night.
You know,
whatever it is you're doing, do. And that was lovely. And it's not that he loved all the work I did. There's some work he loved, some work he just couldn't stand. You know, there are times when we've had conversations about that. But I really appreciated the fact that, you know, it was, this is your thing, you do it. My mother, on the other hand, has, to start with, was my biggest critic. She'd come in quite early in a process and watch a rehearsal or two and then, you know, kind of tear it down. And then somewhere along the line, she switched and has moved to being the most, like, literally the uber cheerleader.
Right, right.
So now I can't take anything she says seriously anymore. So yeah, they did access my work. I worked with both of them on one occasion. I directed my mother in a play once, which was problematic. And I produced a show that my father directed, which was also problematic.
Right.
I mean, partly because the scale of the show, I was a very young producer at the time, and I should not have been directing something of that. I mean, producing something of that scale.
Yeah.
Also, when you're young, you have the bullheadedness of youth. So you're trying to push your way through and... It clashes with the director's way, who's used to a certain system, and we were at loggerheads for a lot of it. And I'm glad for that, because when I actually went on to probably the most important gig of my life, which was to work with a director called Tim Supple, I'd learned humility by then.
Midsummer Night's Dream.
Humility by then. I learned how to shelve my style and absorb the other stuff, because that was my job. I was the assistant director to achieve what he wanted the way he wanted it, not the other way around. And I learned so much working with my father and fighting with him, so that I was in a better place when I worked with Tim, etc. We did interact. It's not something I recommend for anyone to work with family. I don't know. There's some troops that are heavily invested in each other and family, and I it's not something I recommend because it is complicated. You know, even if you're working with someone that you're, you know, married to or in love with or whatever, it's tough. Mm-hmm. It is really tough because rehearsal rooms are not, they're very, they should be safe spaces. They yeah. should be blank spaces. And the moment there's a little bit else in there, it changes the dynamic of how it happens.
Yeah, there's not just emotional baggage that you carry with you, but even after it's done, you know that whatever was communicated within that space was can then
yeah
it's is a, not is not being reset the next time you get into
exactly,
that room.
And it's also a two-way street. Like my mom had been pretty much the mother to all of us growing up. So when we walked into a rehearsal room, she continued that role. And
yeah.
I couldn't get what I wanted out of
right,
her
right, right.
as a performer, because in her head, she was, you know, the door was ringing, the doorbell was ringing, and she
yeah,
was,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
catering to people. I'm going, hello, stop, like, just get the lines.
Yeah.
But remarkably, Arya, who's one of the partners at QTP, he has worked with my mother on numerous occasions, and he's able to bring performances out of her that are just magical. And I have to doff my hat and go, yeah, you know,
yeah.
that's a director actor equation. What I had was not. It wasn't as fruitful as it should. It's not that it was bad or whatever, but it could have been so much more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I would warn people about working
right.
with family, with very close people, with loved ones of any kind. And
right, right.
It's a tough one.
You were talking about how, you know, you're half theater consumer and lover and half creator.
Right.
So during the beginning years, post-college, when you have started this journey of creating your own content and,
right.
and producing and working with others, how much does the fact that you, because you're also consuming so much theater and reading about not just Indian theater,
yeah.
but, you know, educating yourself with, I'm guessing,
also,
the
yeah.
Russian, you know,
yeah.
theater scene and all that, how do you then set that aside, especially during those early years, that what I'm going to create, of course, I'm not trying to emulate or even copy someone else's style. I want to have my original voice, but knowing that there's so much history,
so
how
a,
do you
so hang on,
figure that out?
That's, I mean, instinctively, and this is even now when we're working with a lot of younger people now, you've got to study, all right? You've got to learn what the hell has happened across. And if you trust your instinct, when you walk into the room, the instinct is not something that comes from afar or magically, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is something that is honed, right? And it's honed by study,
right.
by craft, by watching things, right? And once you have it, like my instinct in 1998, when I first started directing, is very different to my instinct now.
Right, right.
Which one is better, I don't know. Which one is truer, they're both true.
Right.
And we are products of what we have studied. We are products of what we have. Like, even with Thespo now, when we watch work and stuff like that, young people's work, and they're like, okay, we're going to tell a story like this. And I mean, do you know the history of that form?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what
right.
else has happened? Because an audience is used to seeing something, and now you're
yeah.
doing an aping of that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And calling it your own when it's not. So just to understand that
right.
a little bit is important. And instinctively, I mean, if you set out what you're saying, which is an analytical approach, if you're saying, okay, I'm gonna find my own way through it
mm-hmm.
and all of that, that's stuff to be done 10 years after you've done the work.
Right.
When you look back and you have a perspective on it. At the time, you can't do that. If you do that, you will fail.
Yeah,
because then you're not being true to the work. You've got to respond to the text, to the actors, to whatever's offered in that room. And then whatever your training is or whatever your study is or whatever your baggage is, which is
mm-hmm.
also a good thing, will guide you through that.
Right.
The moment you say, I don't want to do this and I want to do that, it's really going to be problematic, because then you're trying to build a form or a construction. You're not actually trying to build
right.
a piece of theater. And that ends up getting in the way. So sometimes you react to things saying, hey, I want to create that kind of magic that I witnessed.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you might react in a different way saying, I really don't want to create that. I don't want a room mm-hmm. like that's like that. So, I mean, there was a show that I worked on very, very early when I was a stagehand on a show. And it was a horrible room for actors and production. You know, the actors were their silo, the crew were their silo. And I never want to work in a room like that. And so whenever I was trying to create work, I was always trying to make it a much more unified room.
Mm-hmm.
The production cannot be chasing the same vision as the actors if they're not all chasing it together.
Right, right.
You know, it's not that we're doing and you're doing. You know, that balance doesn't work. So for me, it's very important that everyone in the room, everyone is working in it. Now that's a knee-jerk reaction to working in an environment where I was like, God, I don't want that to ever happen again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't want your product crew thinking, yeah, man, you know, the actor may be good, but like, I'm not in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And you want everyone, you want, theater is so much about energy. It's about live physical energy. It's about the audience being curious and generous about what's happening, for the actors being generous to each other and forth. And the same thing falls to the crew at the back. You know, when those magical moments happen, the actors have to be thankful to the crew, and the
mm-hmm.
crew have to want the actors to succeed. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Otherwise, you're walking in with so much, at least this is my understanding of it. And the same thing sometimes works artistically. You know, you see a style of acting and you're going, that's a bit, you know, that's not mm-hmm. right. That's not something I like. Or you find something that's fantastic and you go, you know. So the Seema Pawar, I think, was in a piece that Motley did. I can't remember the name of the play. It was a play with Nasir on one side and Jameel Khan on the other. They're both very powerful mm-hmm. performers. And she played the mother of Jameel and the wife of Nasir. But she had no lines in the whole piece. It was, I think, a 25-30 minute piece.
Right.
She had no lines. And she'd just come in, hand one a glass of water, go off, come in, sit, pray with her back to the audience, get up, go. And she was mesmerizing. Now, that's something that element of grace, human grace,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a large part of my search when I'm working with actors. I definitely want to draw on that, you know. That doesn't mean I want to make my actor do the same thing. I want mm-hmm. to find that where there is dignity and human grace in a scenario like that.
Yeah.
Make someone that watchable. I mean, what you see, sometimes you borrow from. And then it may not be applicable that year. And suddenly, 2 years down the line, 3 years down the line, you're doing something. And you go, hey, wait a minute, there's something to draw from behind. And you grab that and with both hands, and you try and place it. And if you're just trying to recreate something else, it will not work. Right? There's that lovely thing, right? There is no original thought. Every thought is an amalgamation of something else. And everything, particularly on stage, we've seen before in some way. We just have not seen it in this context or this way or mm-hmm. whatever. So how do you place that is the key. And this also works for theater effects. You know, you see something that you really like and you want to use it later, but then in what context do you want to use it? How is it changing? How is it enriching what you're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it taking away? Is it just a gag? Is it just a, you know, thing? So again, I come back to instinct, right?
Yeah.
What feels right at the time is very, very important.
So if we had to do a little brief history of the, I don't want to go too far back,
right,
of Indian theater as the way it's been used by storytellers as a communication tool, where do you think is the, not the beginning, but what you would say over the last 50 years?
Right.
What is that changing point in
in the industry. And how is that over the last 20 years that you've been involved in it? What has stayed the same and what has changed the most?
So one is, it's a problematic question, mainly because...
Yeah, it's a very long question. I just asked a very long question.
Also because the moment you say, what is Indian theater, it really complicates the issue because
right.
we have so many socio-political linguistic realities, right? At the end of the day, the difference between Kathakali and Terukuttu, right, is not very much. But one is called a folk form and one is a classical form.
Mm-hmm.
One is codified. You need to know the code in order to appreciate it, the other. And that works across the board. So wherever you go across the country, linguistic-wise, it is a problem.
Right.
In the modern urban theater that we refer to in largesse as Indian theater, which is actually not true.
Right.
There obviously has been the huge influence of the well-made play. Now, for example, if you talk about Hindi theater, right? The Hindi canon is actually very small because Hindi is not a historic language. There is very little history. So there are not that many plays,
mm-hmm.
right, that have been written. I mean, if you're comparing it with a Marathi or a Gujarati,
right,
which
right.
has a huge litany of plays, a huge canon of work, or Bengali for that matter. But Hindi is actually an independent India language. It's the lowest common denominator of a lot. So there's no literature that is Hindi in the same way as you'd have it in these other languages. One of the big things that obviously is a huge urban push, and I say this full well knowing that I work in English theatre, was the 70s when Karnad, Badal Sarkar, Mohan Rakesh and Vijay Tendulkar were writing. Because that became the seminal voice of Indian theatre. They were telling Indian stories that were not necessarily about partition,
mm-hmm.
you know, not being nationalistic. It was a new modern, at that time, modern reflection on the times that they were in.
Right.
They were all Indian, right? Even though they were linguistically bound by where they were. And then magically, they all got translated into each other's languages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so suddenly, each one, let's say, wrote 4 or 5 plays. Now, ordinarily, it's okay, there are 5 Kannada plays. But the fact that Badal Sarkar was being translated into Kannada, and suddenly mm-hmm. you got 20 Kannada plays, and you got 20 Marathi plays, and you got 20 Bengali plays, and 20 Hindi plays, which you otherwise would never have had. And I think that was probably the first real understanding of an urban theatre.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, within that, Girish Karnad was writing very folk form, Yakshagana inspired stuff. Right? Vijay Tendulkar was writing more Arthur Miller kind of realistic,
right.
you know, kind of thing. Badal Sarkar was doing almost Dutowski style, you know, protest theatre in a way. So they were all doing very, very different things.
Right.
But for some reason, it all existed at the same time and it was being performed at mm-hmm. the same time. And I think that was the big thing. Now, the thing about Indian theatre or theatre any kind, and we talk a lot about it, and we talk about, yes, you know, the great styles of theatre and the great this and that, but actually, particularly in an Indian context, but it's about what are the stories being told. And do you have stories to tell? And I think that period of time, they had a lot of stuff
mm-hmm.
to say, and they said it, and they were all incredibly prolific. You know, each one of those people, you know, wrote almost 15, 20 plays. Girish Karnad still writing plays. His latest play is just out, you know. So this
right.
this very fertile time where there was
mm-hmm.
so much work happening. And so I think that was a huge turning point for the modern Indian theatre.
Yeah.
And some of it were reactions. So Badal Sarkar's third space, third theatre that he called it, was a reaction to proscenium theatre. He wanted to take it out of the seats and stage and lights
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. And he moved into almost a street theatre kind of format. which still exists, and each one exists, you know, on one on top of the other. And that was a big thing. Obviously, the birth of the NSD is a huge moment, which again is, you know, 60s, 70s. Mm-hmm. So a lot of stuff was happening at the same time. But having said that, within the Marathi theater, there were so many other movements that was happening, Rangayan and, you know, all of that. So that was the first claiming of an identity, a modern identity of Indian theater.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have to be Ramayana and Mahabharata. It didn't have to be partition stories. It didn't have to be nationalistic. You know, so your Diwar, Pathan, that, you know, Prithviraj mm-hmm. Kapoor were doing, were of a certain kind. Similarly, in the mid-2000s or early 2000s, all of a sudden, English became an Indian language. Because up until then, all the English plays were, you know, characters were Martha and George and Mike and Jim. And even if you went to the school level and if you think of English essays that were written in the 80s and 90s, you know, that kids were writing in school,
mm-hmm.
the names of the characters were all of this.
Yeah,
because our children's books were only Enid Blyton.
Yeah.
We had no Indian children's books in English, you know. And then there was suddenly this change where suddenly Indian storytelling, it was okay to tell an Indian story in English.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused its own flow, you know, and its own renaissance of that. And it was quite remarkable because all of a sudden there was an audience that wanted to watch work, but an urban audience, on how we speak.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, which is not the Queen's English, it's our English, it's mm-hmm. our chat, it's our kind of, you know, mix and match and flowing in and out of languages sometimes. Our own intonations, you know. And that continues to today. I mean, the amount of new writing that's happening in Bombay and Delhi and Bangalore is really remarkable when you compare it in English.
Yeah.
When you compare it to what's happened earlier. So again, there's another burst that's happening, and hopefully that will continue. And I don't just mean in English, I mean in all languages. I mean, Hindi's had a huge resurgence in the last 15, 20 years. Purvanesh, Manav Kaul, you know, writing prolifically. There's a lot of people writing, a lot of work. You know, I mean, Manav has been writing, I think he only started in the 2000s, he's written already like 15 or 20 plays, you know what I mean? So, that, and if you go to Delhi University, all of Manav's plays are being performed. And he did an amazing thing. The other day, he put up a Facebook post saying, nobody has to ever ask me for rights. Anyone can use it. You know, use my work whenever they want without, you don't have to ask me, just stage it. Just let me know that you've done it, but that's it. That's incredible. You know, you're building a canon of work, and it's so there is a lot of very, very cool, interesting stuff that's happening. It's a very exciting time to be in the theater. It's also a very exciting time to be a theater consumer. Because every night you're going to something else in a weirder space than, you know, it's mm-hmm. not just the regular venues, there are other venues coming up all over the city. I mean, in Bangalore, in Delhi, in Calcutta, there are these little spaces coming up. Pune, you know, Ahmedabad has three or four smaller spaces. So all these places have all emerged. So it's a very, very exciting time right now to be there because writers are writing, there are new spaces happening which are now mm-hmm. inspiring directors to play with form.
Yeah.
So there's a lot, like in Bombay, for example, we've had so much more movement theatre and we've had a whole bunch of devised work. And suddenly the gender question is hugely prevalent in all the plays happening, in a lot of the plays happening in Bombay. Fantastic. It's mm-hmm. a really good time to do that, you know. And it's a really good selection of work that is rigorous and is pushing an envelope in some kind.
So shifting to Thespo.
Yep.
You started that 20 years ago, right?
Yeah.
What was the general philosophy? Not goal, but like philosophy of wanting to start Thespo?
It really happened by fluke. We were in a college auditorium. We were watching some plays we were actually competing in the same festival in Malhar, and a play called Sadhya started. And the moment the curtain opened, I turned to the rest of our team and I went, guys, they've got it. We are out. And it was a really remarkable piece of theatre by Ruya College, directed by a guy called Himanshu Joshi. And one of the performers was a girl called Shitizo. And it was a remarkable piece of theatre, beautifully written, beautifully staged. And I remember thinking to myself at that time that this is so much better than any of the other, in quotes, professional work we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't there more people in this auditorium receiving this? And literally there was no one. There was just our team, one guy asleep on the sound console, the lighting guy digging his nose, and that was it. And Christopher and myself both had the same idea, which is, wouldn't it be great if more people saw this kind of work? And we went away, and then one day we met, and working independently, we both come up with the idea for a festival, a one-act festival, that placed theatre and the quality of the theatre at the centre. It wasn't, this is a college festival, these are the lights for the fashion show, use it for your plays, mm-hmm. you know, because fashion was the big thing, and, you know, and to give it a certain respect and a certain, for want of a better phrase, professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with a costume for YB Chavan. I had come up with a costume for Sophia's, and it just happened like that. And we went, okay, let's do a feasibility thing, and we just went with it. And the first year was literally a one evening kind of thing, three one act plays, but in between each play, while the other teams were setting up, there was performances. So it was a proper full evening of stuff, and it was better received than we thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had 600 people who turned up and, you know, really enjoyed the evening and kept saying, oh, I hope next year is as good. And we're going, next year. Okay, so one is, when Thespo started, we were incredibly arrogant and naive, where we as a bunch of 20-year-olds thought we could go in and tell other 20-year-olds what to do.
Right.
And I don't think we there were a lot of people that we rubbed the wrong way. But if we weren't arrogant, naive, and foolish, we would never have got it going. Like,
right.
Like it was one of those things, right? The strength was the fact we didn't know we were doing this. And I will say this much, that the intent was always about trying to make theatre better, right? So it was never an ego trip. We never performed as part of that for, you know, like, even though we were, it wasn't our thing to do. We were very clear
that
this is what was happening. But remarkably, even when I talk to people about the kind of work that has happened and stuff, everyone assumes that, yes, you know, oh, young people say it must be all about love. And we, like, if you look across the ridiculous number of plays that have happened and the 70-odd plays that were newly written for Thespo, you will find very little love in them. It's not, you know, the soppy kind of thing. And so the one thing is that there is year on year, there's a remarkable response to the surroundings.
Right.
So for example, in 2005, when, you know, all of India had this ridiculously big monsoon, the number of plays we saw in October that were either about storms or about rain or about, you know, some of it was just a poetry thing about rain, something
mm-hmm.
else, was quite severe. I remember one year we saw a lot of plays and they all had guns in them for some reason, right? Which was crazy. So these are all so there is a huge response to what is happening.
Right.
And it gets interpreted in its own way, sometimes in form, sometimes in content. But also the scope of Thespo has gotten wider. So when Thespo started, it was originally a Bombay festival. Then it moved to being Bombay and Bangalore. Then Bombay, Bangalore, Delhi.
Mm-hmm.
Then for a few years, we were kind of our urban centers only. So Pune, you know. Well, today, it's all over the place. And now Thespo, kind of, we've got entries from Ernakulam and Huda and, you know, smaller towns and smaller things. So I don't think it's a comparable, it's a fair comparison, because you can look at what work has happened in Bombay over the years and compare that.
Right.
But I don't think it's fair to compare, you know, what we are now accessing,
right,
which we
right.
earlier didn't. And it is quite remarkable, some of the work that we have seen. One of the big things is a lot of the stronger work is newly written work, because there seems to be less work being picked off a bookshelf, more work being presented that is owned, you know, there's greater ownership. And I think the other side of it is people who are writing their own stories, they are investing far more in the production. By that I mean time and effort. Than someone who's picked a book off the shelf. So it is quite interesting, those things that have started happening. And the other big thing is that linguistically, we're struggling to classify plays now. Like at one point you could do, yeah, okay, that's a Hindi play, that's an English play, that's a Marathi play. And now it's Marathi English, Hindi Kannada. You know, it's like it's all over these little permutation. One year we had an English Kannada play, you know, so, and that's quite remarkable. The Thespo that went by, we had a plain gibberish. I mean, in no language. Not even gibberish. Gibberish is a language, you know, in no language. We had one year we had a play from Sri Lanka, which had not a single spoken word, you know. So you end up with all this this kind of mix and match and all that. So it's quite interesting what is happening. My role and our role, all of us who started it out, and now we're 20 years later, we're still very involved in Thespo as a movement. We're not so much involved in the day-to-day running and the plays that come in. We're now looking at what are the opportunities or what are the new ideas that we want to, you know, where we wanted to go in 5 years' time or 10 years' time. So we're looking more at strategy and things like that. And a lot of the new initiatives and the current mad drive that is there for Thespo is heavily reliant on the people who run the festival. Because the festival is also run by people under 25.
Yeah.
Also, importantly, it's not just a festival. We now do stuff throughout the year. We're doing workshops constantly. You know, there are events happening throughout the year. The festival is only one part of a much larger movement of trying to build a global community. So now we're showcasing. So when we started, we were just trying to showcase work. This is good work. People should see it.
Yeah.
Now we're showcasing, we're training, we're collaborating with international people. We're celebrating, you know, we're giving lifetime achievement awards and, you know, awards and stuff like that. We're really, you know, applauding people who've done great work. And we do that through all our events. So whether it's a workshop or this, and we're building a community. The idea is to build a community of young theatre lovers, currently nationally, but hopefully worldwide as well. Like next week, there's a workshop in Pune with an Italian company who happens to be in Pune. So we're putting a workshop together. Thespo's putting a workshop. I had no idea about this workshop till yesterday. I suddenly saw it on Facebook and I'm going, guys, is this something we're doing? Like, yeah, it's, you know. So it is wonderful. I mean, this year we turned 20 and last year, 2018. And I was asked to make a speech because we are 20. So at the rap party, I'm standing there. And there was a lovely moment because I had to stand up and introduce who I was. Right? Like nobody knew. This generation is now so, you know, like they don't know. There's been no interaction. They don't care. You know, this old man in the corner is suddenly standing up and saying something. And it was really funny because one of the guys, probably quite drunk, came up to me afterwards. Someone who's attending came up to me after and said, "Bhai, jab tu bola na, sab log chup hoke sun rahe the. Tu bahut aage jayega." I was like, "Thank you." You know? So it really was like they had no idea. And I think it's lovely. I think that's a very positive thing for the movement. You know, it has to move on its steam. It has to go forward on what it is. You know, it can't constantly be pushed or dragged down by us oldies. It has to be new. It has to constantly evolve. And that's really testament to the generations that have happened, you know, that have been carrying it, you know, 2011 onwards. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a whole other world of guys who suddenly one day woke up and said, you know, why are we just an urban festival? Let's go find stuff. Yeah. Like, it's a village called Islampur in the middle of Maharashtra. It takes 6 hours to go there by road, and we've had like 3 and 4 players come from there. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that's fantastic. I have no idea where it was when suddenly they went, "Achha, there's a player from Islampur." I'm going, "Where's that?" And then you got to find it on the map and, you know, chart out how we can get an Ola to go there. So, yeah, I mean, that's quite remarkable, the kind of stuff that's happening. And the fact that people around the country are saying, "Hey, we want to do this."
Yeah.
That's
the
other side of it, you know. So, yes, it is a showcase and it is that. And there are workshops happening and there is all of that. So I don't know what the trend differences are. And if you look back, one of the problems is when we look back, we also look back with the rose-tinted glasses, right? And you go, yeah, you know, in Thespo 5, that play was fantastic.
Yeah, because
I knew everything about that play. I was part of the guys organizing. Yeah. I you know, ran and got the pink gel that was required. Do you know what I mean? There was so much more involvement. Yeah. So it's a very dangerous thing to look back and say, you know, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
This is not. One thing we did do this year was we released a book, a collection of 4 plays that had happened at the festival over the years.
Thespo Rights.
So what was very interesting was sifting through all the material. I mean, it was edited by Ramu Ramanathan and Iravati Karnik. So they had to go through the 71 odd plays and they picked these 4 for this volume. And 2 are Marathi, 1 is Hindi, 1 is English. And when you look at that, you go, okay, that's quite something. But if you look at the range of years where they have featured, 2005 was Butter and Mash Banana, you know, all the way up to 2015 or 16, which is Bhavar, you know, maybe 2017, which is Bhavar, no, 2016, which is Bhavar. So it's a huge range, you know, of when work has happened, and it's all strong work, you know, so that's you can't really comment on when and how and what, you know, it was. And the testament to the movement is a lot of the people who have been part of it have remained in the theater. So yes, they've gone on incredibly lucrative careers in film and visible careers, you know, or even invisible careers as writers or set designers or whatever. But they've all kept one foot in the theater. And I think that's a real achievement. So if you look at the first generation of people like an Akash Khurana or Afrisha Bowman Barama, Romo Nasunawala, or Shiti Zog, who have built a reputation, there's some, you know, celluloid presence, etc. That's great. But then you also have the Abhay Mahajans and the Mithila Palkars who are, you know, 2000 and they are Thespo 15 onward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in the middle there, you've got an Ali Fazal and an Imrat Kaur and, you know, all of that. So the fact that consistently and these guys still come back to do theater.
Right.
That's the win for us. You know, it's not just a stepping stone that we've stepped on Thespo, it's taken us to professional theater and we've, you know, squeezed that down and now we're stars. Mm-hmm. You know, no, these guys have all come back and they all keep doing Neil Bhupalam or, you know, they all got one they give them half a chance, Richa Chadda, you know, Huma, they all are still interacting and coming back to the theater, which is very, very pleasing.
Yeah.
You know, as someone who's been part of a movement saying, "Hey, this, yeah, that's right. Right. That's correct."
I read that you brought Naseem Suleimanpur.
Yeah.
You brought his very unique show, White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, to India. And just to give people who are listening who has no idea what that is, what is White Rabbit, Red Rabbit? And what made you feel like this is something Indian audiences will be able to, you know, be interested in and absorb?
So there is something that's happening with storytelling or playwriting in general. Naseem's project was actually remarkable because he completely does away with the director, right? For those who don't know, his piece, basically, White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, every night, an actor can only play it once. The actor receives the text on stage in front of the audience. So the actor's never read the work, has not allowed to have watched it. It doesn't mean the actor has no skills. The actor still is an actor.
He has to be able to
communicate and broadcast and create a world for an audience. But the play is really like a letter from Naseem to the audience, right?
And the actor is just the vessel.
And is literally the vessel. And it absolutely is the absence of a director. When I was watching the shows, I still take notes. But there's no point because the next actor is completely different. But having said that, so it's quite an interesting conversation between the actor and the audience. And there's this shared terror because the audience doesn't know what's happening. And now the actor doesn't know what's happening. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, the actor is acting like they don't know what's happening. And
They have written, like, oh, I don't know the third act. I don't have to act surprised.
The audience has that bind that, okay, I know, you know, they are guiding me. Here they're both as thing. In fact, we've had some actors who have started off by being, you know, a bit coy and cool, you know, like, you know, this stuff. And they've got to the third page and gone, man, fuck that shit. I'm just going to say the next line as it comes. So that was a really interesting experiment. And we did a huge number of shows. And we translated to Hindi and Marathi as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we did shows in Delhi and Pune and Bombay and, you know, all over. And Bangalore. And it is a remarkable piece of theatre. And it is taking playwriting to another space. I think theatre, because it's the oldest of all the performing art forms, it's had to constantly reinvent itself as newer things have taken sections of it.
Right.
So, for example, proscenium theatre was big, then cinema arrived, and now, you know, proscenium theatre is actually cinema, right? Actor is far away, somewhere, you know, on that side of the stage, and the audience is on the other side of the stage. Then theatre became intimate, you know, you were doing small stuff and whatever, but then television came into your house, so now how can you be more intimate than that?
Right.
So theatre's constantly tried to evolve, so then theatre has now become interactive, so if you look at troops like Punch Drunk or things like that, you know, who are doing stuff that is requiring an audience to make more of an effort to move around the space and interact with that. And I think playwriting has also gone into that space. If you look at, you know, Mike Bartlett's work, you know, with Cork or with Bull, which is basically just do, you know, like the set, the stage directions are minimal, you know, and it's literally, there's no set and everything is mine. That buy-in has to be from an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Naseem is also in that space. There's another playwright, creator called Tim Crouch, and he does something similar with a play called The Tree, I think, and again, he plays the actor, but he gets a different actor to play opposite him every night. So again, there's some structure there, but it's still spontaneous, surprise for both sides. And Naseem's written a second play called Blank, which we also stage shows of, and Blank, interestingly, was much more audience interactive. And the whole narrative is built by an audience member. It's his storyline. And you create a story with the audience there. And in fact, his third play, which right now we've been talking to him about, which is called Naseem, actually has to have him in the play every night. So he has to be present.
Really?
And again, a new actor comes every night.
That one's in, and that's not even, that's supposed, I read that you're supposed to know Farsi for, at least the ones he's doing in New York, where they're the actors supposed to speak a little bit.
They are, but I don't know if they're supposed to know Farsi.
Okay.
They should be.
The audience doesn't need to know what it is.
But it is quite remarkable. And for me, for looking at Nassim's work now with an analytical hat on, is it's very much a search for identity. Because the first play was written because he wasn't allowed to travel out of Iran. So how do I get my work out in the vision that I want without attending a rehearsal? So that's how that format happened. The second one is, again, about identity, but it's not about him. It's about the audience member's identity. And now the third one clearly is the lens is very much on him because he is present. And then if you look at people like Duncan McMillan who are writing, or you look at, there's a creator called Daniel Bai who creates very, very interesting shows in the UK. And again, the playwriting is taking a different shape. It cannot be recreated by another medium.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be reprinted. And each night is unique because of that night. Because of the people in that room and how it happened. In fact, in the new play that I'm working on, which is a Duncan McMillan play called Every Brilliant Thing, it is a structured piece, it is a text, it is in care, but it is highly interactive. And so much of it depends on the interactions. So again, night after night, it will change. One of the big challenges is how do you rehearse something like that?
Yeah.
You know, and how do you, you know, cross all the T's and dot all the I's. And that's one of the things we've been struggling with. But it is the narrative will still remain. The little bits in there will change a bit. So I think that more and more we're trying to find new ways for theater to engage with an audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in an age where if an audience is too passive for too long, they'll go to their phones.
Yeah.
Right? How do you counter that? So I think interactivity and some of the newer playwrights are really taking that challenge head on. And this is not just in the UK. It's happening all over the world.
Yeah.
It's an interesting space. And Nassim, when he came to Literature Live. We brought him to Literature Live. And it was incredible. I mean, the story of getting him here was another whole story. Because he's an Iranian passport holder, but trying to apply in Germany, his passport, it all took much longer.
Yeah, yeah.
And the day he was supposed to arrive and then do a session, but he hadn't got his passport yet. And we knew there was a flight at about 2:30 in the afternoon. So he literally had a bag packed, kept by his door, and we were just waiting for the courier to come with the visa. And the doorbell rang, and was the courier, and this was about 12 noon. Remember, he's got a tooth.
Yeah.
And he literally just took the package, ripped it open, right, saw the passport, then grabbed his bag, got into the car, called me when he was on the way to the airport, saying, I'm on the way to the airport. We booked his ticket while he was, there. He got to the airport, we emailed him his ticket, he got on the plane, he arrived. He literally went to sleep for about 2 hours, and he had a 10:30 morning session, we put him in a hotel that was near, you know, the airport. We had, and then he was there for 2 days, and then I only got to meet him at about 2 o'clock in the morning the night the festival finished. And we spent 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. just chatting about theater and things like that.
Yeah.
4 a.m. he picked up his bag and he went back on the plane and he left, you know, because it was so it was a remarkable kind of thing. And even what he was talking about, which is about what the role of playwriting is. And also, if you look at the world today, we've, in a lot of the work we consume, the level of artifice has dropped. The level of well-madeness has dropped.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the rise of reality TV, although yes, it is, a lot of it is scripted reality. I mean, there's a term for that. But if you look at the rise of reality, look at MTV right now, there's nothing that is actually music anymore. It's all reality.
Mm-hmm.
And our fascination with that. So just as our films and stuff are getting more and more fantastical, your Marvel and Star Wars,
mm-hmm.
you know, your big money spinners are there. A lot of the other stuff is getting, for want of a better phrase, more and more real.
Yeah.
And then you go to a You've got your reality TV, which is then sliding into, look at what spoken word has done. You know, now it's not an actor reading a speech or a poem to an audience and wowing them with content. There is a almost an unwritten bond which says, this is my story, but there's a greater buy-in because it is that person's story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in fact, I was looking at something, you know, some spoken word stuff saying, ooh, actors are going to struggle now. Because how do you own genuineness like that? How do you get an audience to say, to believe more? Because the moment you stand up on stage and start saying something, like, yeah, that's a writer's line. That's not so then something like Naseem's project becomes very interesting because that panic is that actor's panic.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know what the next line is going to be. And I don't know I don't know what's going to happen. So I think there's that wrestle that's happening right now with the theater and in a lot of our art forms, which is how do you capture honesty and truth minus the artifice, minus the bells and whistles. I think that's because cinema has gone in that space. Look at Game of Thrones, look at Harry Potter, look at, you know, Lord of the Rings. They've gone into this fantasy world. So then
they're taking advantage of their medium.
Absolutely.
And
you know?
Theater can, because so
then,
it is
so
interactive, it's a reaction,
yeah,
it can do that.
Because we can't, I mean, I know they tried on the West End to recreate Harry Potter and all of that. And you can do it to some extent.
I mean,
extent.
They disastrously did Spider-Man
So, I mean, you can try and do that and it will make some indent somewhere. But there's also the other side, which is to try and bring it just much more bare bones, much more open. And honest storytelling is becoming more and more the thing. Authentic storytelling.
Yeah. So this is, I know I said that would be the last question, but I now have like a, I have like more of a closing, little bit of a more of a conclusive question. And it's more grounded in your opinion on the art form as well. What do you think makes a story fit for the theater medium? What are, for you as a storyteller, what tells you that, oh, that's perfect for this medium compared to, you know, other ways in which that story could be told?
So one is, I don't think we pick stories like that. And I'm talking quite personally here. I've never seen a play and said it would make a better film.
Right.
I've seen a play and said, oh, that would translate well to film. Or I've seen a film and said that would translate well to the theater. But I don't think I think they're all valid ways. And how you do it So Laramie Project, which is an incredible play about a hate crime that happened in the US. And again, you're talking about authenticity. It's a really documentary theater. I think it's this group of theater people there was a crime that happened in Laramie, and they went to research the crime, and then the play is them sharing their research and their interviews with the shopkeeper, with the this, with the that. And it's a group of eight, I think, and they all play various parts. And there's a certain honesty about that. Now I will play this part and tell you about this. And now I'll do that. When it got converted into a film, how do you keep that distance that, remember, you're telling the story of someone else? Because the moment you put an actor in that part of the shopkeeper, that there's a oh, is that true? Is that the person? You know?
Right.
And what they did was remarkable. So the main characters who are doing these interviews were unknowns. But all the people that they are interviewing were very well-known screen names.
Mm.
So Kathy Bates turns up somewhere and this and that. Mm. So the moment they appear, you immediately have that shock of, oh, it's that. And then you're only listening to their information. It's almost Brechtian in the way that it's broken convention. So, and that's fantastic because they were able to take the play, which I would have, when I read it, think this is unfilmable, and they managed to find a film way to do it. The only way I can answer that is when there's... I like doing stories that I feel need to be told.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes not even because an audience is interested in it. It just, it's a story that needs to be aired.
Yeah.
And put out in the cosmos or whatever. So that's why I pick. That's how I choose. That's, it has to drive me. Also, it's something that's going to stay with you for a few months. So that's mm-hmm. something that really charges you up. That's not to say we don't do work for hire and we don't do, you know, someone gives you a commission and says, do this.
Yeah.
So that's one way of picking and choosing how you do. But I don't think I've seen it's a lovely story. So there's a playwright called Annie Zerdi, and she sees things very visually, almost filmically. Like, I've read one of her plays called Jal, and it's literally, she talks about them on a boat, and then they turn and look at the shore, and the shore is really far away, and there's a crowd on the shore, and then they look back, and suddenly it's, she almost describes a close-up of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's a very, when you're reading it, you're thinking films.
Yeah, yeah.
So she was writing a play for us called So Many Songs. And one night, 11:30 at night, she sent me a text going, ha, ha, ha. So I said, what? She said, you'll see tomorrow. So what was happening is she was sending in scenes. We were rehearsing them, then she was going away and writing.
Okay.
Next day, she turns up to rehearsal and she hands me a piece of paper. And on it says, the horseman, which is one of the characters, the horseman rides towards the audience and bursts into flames. I looked at her and went, eh? And she went, it's just an image I had. So now you have to deal with it. And ordinarily, you think that's a very filmic thing. How can you do it?
Yeah.
But that's also because we're thinking very naturalistically.
Mm.
And I handed it to the choreographer and the actor playing the horseman. And they went away and they played with stuff and they came back and they went away again and came back. And literally, I think 5 days before we opened, they came back with a sequence which was just remarkable. And it was inspired by that moment. But basically, it's the character taking a elastic band and just wrapping it around himself and eventually covering his face and then shivering and then breaking down using his own mm-hmm. choreography style and crumbling to the floor. And it was magical. And why he was doing that in rehearsal, suddenly the tabla player stood up and started just giving some kind of beat to his movement. And then the designer came in and said, okay, fine. So this elastic band we made yellow. Mm-hmm. And to date, it is the most powerful image of the play. And it became a fulcrum moment. And I joined three other scenes to that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one catching fire. There's another scene where, at the same simultaneously happening, where a woman, the mother, finds a can of kerosene. There's another scene where a young son takes off his shirt and just looks at himself in the mirror. There's another, the grandmother tearing apart images of the Tibetan martyrs who've immolated themselves. Now, that piece of writing created all
right.
of this. Now, we were so close to saying, yeah, chuck that out.
Yeah.
It's not
yeah.
doable. Chuck it. You know, and then she had some other one, which is the rider rides towards the audience and picks up the audience in the crook of his arm, you know. And we then found a way to do that. It wasn't riding, you know, but in our vocabulary, what would that be?
Right.
And I'm really thankful for Annie for that, because if she'd just written conventionally, we would never have got there.
Hmm.
So a lot of it is the push and pull and
yeah.
the tug and the fight with it. So I do believe it doesn't matter what
yeah.
the medium is. The way to work it is, how do you translate it for your medium?
Right.
Whatever, whether it's television or something. So, yes, you know, oh, that's such a TV movie or that's such a thing. Yes, those comments do come out.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're honest to what you're trying to do, you should be able to find a better way. I mean, I'm fascinated by the challenge that what we do on stage should not be... If you videoed it, it should not you should lose something.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm passionate about
that. Yeah.
But that's my work. Having said that, there are some very good plays that are very well made and staged, and if you film that, they still hold. But for my own work, I'm much more interested in exciting the audience's imagination and not spoon feeding and trying to find moments of interaction emotionally or whatever that will change that, and stagings that will challenge that.